dedicating this year. First of all, Moshe ben Dvorah underwent a difficult operation today. Hashem should give him a refuah shleima, b'zvat Hashem, and his Torah should be in Zchus. And today's learning Bechlal, and tonight's shir is dedicated to Menachem Mendel ben Tzvi Hirsch, Martin Annenberg. Today was his 15th yortzeit, Ezra's grandfather. Ezra, you're going to stand up and give us our Torah now, no? I'm just kidding. All right, no problem. But it should be an ilui for his neshama. Later in the Q&A, if you're curious why we do that and what that means, and just how much something learned in memory of someone impacts their neshama, according to Chazal, it's an unbelievable thing to know. You can ask me afterwards. I think some of us talked about this last week. So let's talk about this. So, Parshat Yitro. You're on your way to Shul for Ne'ilah. You know, you're 16 years old. You went home. You had a little break in the afternoon after Musaf. You got a couple hours. Maybe you relaxed. Maybe you took a shluf. And now you're walking with your dad and your brothers back to Shul, Lincoln Square Synagogue, for Ne'ilah. Right? For Mincha Ne'ilah. Yom Kippur. And you pass by this treif gummer restaurant. I mean, like little piglets roasting in the and chicken and maybe with cheese, I don't know, whatever. And even though it sounds disgusting, the smell is unbelievable. And it's Yom Kippur, you're starving. And it's actually awesome. Like, you just smell it, like you want to like slow down and just enjoy that smell, you know? Right? And then you have this moment of guilt. Like, I'm enjoying treif food on Yom Kippur. Like, I'm smelling treifus and I'm enjoying it. And you feel like, maybe I shouldn't be walking on the side of the street. Maybe I should hold my nose. And I had that experience every year when I was a kid, walking to Shul on Yom Kippur. We would pass by this treif restaurant, and I would look forward to getting next to the treif restaurant because that smell was unbelievable. And it actually gave me a little koch. Anybody here have, in your shul, had the alta kaker, the old guy with the snuff, and he'd come around on Yom Kippur, and right, you know, whoa, right, okay? We had that guy. I never got that. I was like, shoot me, right? This one, this is the snuff you want. This was like mangal. Like, you know, almost like the base of Mikdash and the offering of Karbanos. It's going to smell like a barbecue here. Everybody's going to want to come here. Is that a problem? So the truth is, years later, when I was studying for Smicha, I finally discovered the sugya. And it turns out, Reicha Lav Miltahi, smell is not a thing. There's no isur to smell tray food. You're good. Okay. But then there's another problem. Is there a problem wanting tray food? No. In fact, you could make a case of saying the fact that you want to eat treif and you don't puts you on a higher level. I have no interest in eating cheeseburgers. So I'm not going to let a lot of war run into the sky if I'm not eating cheeseburgers. Right? The Vilna Gaon is not going to, you know, get tremendous schar in Shemayim because he didn't have an adulterous affair. He's the Vilna Gaon. It's ridiculous. How important is what we want? And I'll go a stage further. So, I'm on a trip years ago. I think it was during the Second Intifada, but whatever. And I'm in some motel after a long day, and I turn on, I think it was the BBC. And it was during a very difficult time in Eretz Israel. I wasn't happy to be away. And there was a pigua. Some of us had this experience. We were in Poland. There was a pigua. Terrible story. 7 people were killed. You know. But I'm in some motel in, I don't know, Chvesnish land. And I turn on the TV, and there's a BBC report. And it's in the middle of a report, and there's a woman. And it's a close-up of her face. And she looks like a beautiful woman, and she's got this tear in the corner of her eye. And she's talking in English. And the interviewer is asking her something along the lines of, like, you know, can you tell me about him, whatever, he was a wonderful boy. And I suddenly realize this is obviously the mother of somebody who was killed in this pigua, in this terrorist act. And then the camera pans to like a corner. There's a soccer ball in the corner, a pair of sneakers, whatever. And she says to him, you know, how do you feel about all this? She says, I wish I could have taken his place. Are you proud of him? I'm so proud of him. And I'm listening to this, and within about 30 seconds I realize, I'm not listening to the mother of one of the victims. I'm listening to the mother of the suicide bomber. Now put aside whether, thank you, put aside sort of whether there's something seriously wrong by giving a platform to the mother of a suicide bomber, homicide bomber. I'm going to leave that aside. You got to love the BBC. This woman was proud of her son. She wishes she could take his place. Does that make her a terrorist? How much is what you want a part of who you are? How much is what you want halakhically an issue? Now, why do I bring this up? Because this is the parsha, one of the central topics of the entire Torah, which is, pardon? Matan Torah. And there are two fascinating things to talk about in Matan Torah. First of all, it's interesting. You know, I was actually learning with somebody a piece from Rav Nevinzal. Asked a great question. We will say on the night of the Seder, right? Ilu kirvanu lifnei Har Sinai velo natan lanu et haTorah dayenu. Hashem had brought us to Har Sinai, but never given us the Torah. That would have been enough. And you read that, and the biggest problem with dayenu is that they put it right before dinner. Nobody has time to talk perush on dayenu because they're hungry. They want to get to dinner. So usually, what people do is they talk about dayenu during dinner or later or earlier or whatever. But it's a very difficult question. What value would Har Sinai have if you didn't get the Torah? So the truth is, the ma'amad of Har Sinai, the experience of standing before Hashem, of seeing what they saw, according to Chazal, the entire Jewish people reached a level of nevuah. They're able to see things that we can't even begin to perceive, itself would have been worthwhile even without getting the Torah. And then, of course, there's the Torah. Now, the reflection of the Torah in this week's parasha is not the entire Torah, it's a Aseret HaDibrot, right? The Ten Commandments, right? And the Ten Commandments, just so you understand, I mean, it's worth taking a moment to think about the Aseret HaDibrot. I don't know if you know this, but they found a pair of tefillin in Qumran in connection with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and another pair of tefillin on Masada. And these tefillin are the same tefillin we have, except for one difference. And that is, want to guess? There were five parashiot, not four. What's the fifth parasha? Unfortunately, they did not keep the order. So we don't know who's right, Rabbeinu Tam or Rashi. That's a whole interesting discussion. But they found these tefillin. And they had their Aseret HaDibrot in it. We don't do that anymore. There's a very long treatise in the Sifri, Medrash Halacha, that's all about why people have to not put the Aseret HaDibrot anymore in their tefillin. Right. In fact, there's a famous tshuva. There's an igeret actually in the Rambam. There's a rav who wrote. I don't think we know who the rav is, but whatever. The rav from a particular community wrote to the Rambam. He had come to a community, or was it somebody who wrote about the rav? I don't remember. He'd come to a community, and in this community, they used to stand for Aseret HaDibrot. And his community's custom was you don't stand for the Aseret HaDibrot. Now, why did they used to fight that people shouldn't stand for the Aseret HaDibrot? So, as a broader topic, because people shouldn't think that the Ten Commandments, that those mitzvot, are any more important than any of the other mitzvot. Kashrus is not in the Ten Commandments. Right? Okay. But on a deeper, more contextually historical level, there was a significant group, not clear how significant, that, you know, sort of akin to like Karaim or Tzedukim, who attempted to espouse the theology that the Aseret HaDibrot were the only mitzvah we have to keep, because those we received directly from Hashem. All the other mitzvah were not given to us by God. Moshe came up with them, and we don't have to follow them. Their time has passed. So in order to negate this, Chazal felt very strongly to limit, right? There's a Mishnah in Tamid, the beginning of Masechta Tamid, excuse me, that says that the Kohanim used to say the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ma'amad, and then the Prakim of Kriyat Shema. These two things were created, were connected. And they stopped this minhag, Ezra stopped this minhag, so that people shouldn't think the Aseret HaDibrot are more important. And yet, and so someone asked the Rambam, so this Rav came, and he told his community that we shouldn't be standing, we should sit. And then he finished the job, I guess he passed away or something, and another Rav came, and his minhag was to stand. And someone in the community said that, you know, they had learned that you shouldn't stand because then you give a ma'amad to these Aseret HaDibrot. And Chazal were against this for reasons I just mentioned. The Rambam is very clear that you should not stand for the Aseret HaDibrot. Rabbi Sachs actually has an interesting article on the topic. And yet, even though the Rambam says you shouldn't stand for the Aseret HaDibrot, go around the Jewish world this Shabbat, and you will see that there are many, many communities that stand for the Aseret HaDibrot. The Jewish people instinctively understand that these are a very significant group of mitzvot. Now, why are they a very significant group of mitzvot? So Rashi actually makes this clear. Rashi in Mishpatim, if I can find it quickly, that would be great. Rashi says, do I have this here? Yeah. This is Mishpatim Perek Chaf Dalet, which is also part of Matan Torah. Right? Kol Sheish Mot Shloshei Mitzvot, all the 613 mitzvot, Bichlal Aseret HaDibrot Hein. They're included in the Aseret HaDibrot. The Aseret HaDibrot are like a vote of all the mitzvot. They're the major categories of mitzvot. And Rashi continues, V'Rabbe Misadya, right? Yisei L'chol Dibur Dibur Mitzvot HaTliyot. Misadya explained how each Dibur helps you to understand all the other mitzvot that are connected to it. So each one of these mitzvot, these Aseret HaDibrot, are the major categories of mitzvot. And that's why it's so important. Okay. So I understand. And that leads us to our question. The 10th Dibur, the conclusion of the Aseret HaDibrot, one of the bookends, is Lo Tachmod. What is the mitzvah of Lo Tachmod? Right? Lo Tachmod, Beit Re'echa, right? You shouldn't covet your neighbor's house. Lo Tachmod, Eshet Re'echa, his wife, right? Avdo Amator Sharoch Amarokol Sharoch. You're not supposed to want what belongs to your neighbor. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand it's not nice to want what your neighbor has, and we'll talk about what that mitzvah actually is. Why is that in the Aseret HaDibrot? I mean, not to murder, not to steal, Shabbos, Emunah, Lo Tin'af, adultery, and don't want what your neighbor has. That's one of the Aseret HaDibrot? That's one of the pinnacles of Judaism? Why is this so important? And if in fact this is such an important mitzvah, why is this what concludes all of Aseret HaDibrot? The Aseret HaDibrot is a progression. There's a big debate as to whether the first dibra, the first mitzvah, is Anochi, which is what the Rambam says, or Anochi is an introduction to the Aseret HaDibrot, and like the Ibn Ezra says, Lo Tishtachav Elohim is where you start the actual mitzvah. And it builds progressively. Right? Believe in God. Don't have idolatry. Don't carry Hashem's name in vain. Shabbos, Kibbud Avim. It builds. Don't murder, don't steal. And then, Lo Tachmod. What is that doing there? Okay? Third question. Very interesting. If you look in Dvarim, you find a repetition, as we know, of all the Aseret HaDibrot. But there are a few differences. What's the most famous difference between the first set of Aseret HaDibrot and the second? No? What's the biggest difference in the Nusach of the Mitzvah? Come on. Every Lechadudi, yeah? Ah! In the Aseret HaDibrot of Yitro, which was given in Har Sinai, Zachorot Yom HaShabbat. In the repetition of the Aseret HaDibrot, given to the second generation, or repeated to the second generation, Shamorot Yom HaShabbat. How do we explain the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is repeating the mitzvot that we were given in Har Sinai, and he changes the Nusach? How do we explain that? We sing it every Friday night. Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. It's given in one, at the same time. By the way, just an aside, this is a very difficult question. Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. That's a mitzvah. That's a naze. We can't possibly comprehend that. How could you hear two words at the same time? Okay, and you can experiment with this afterwards. Get one guy to say Zachor. I did this 1 year. And get one guy to say Shamor, and do 1, 2, 3, and say both at the same time, and it'll be gibberish. You will not be able to follow it. Either one is louder. How could we hear both words at the same time? It's, by the way, an especially difficult question, because the Rambam of the Mor Nevuchim makes very clear, he's not the only one, that the Nisim that occurred when we left Egypt were all Nisim that we could comprehend. Right? There are no Nisim in the Torah that are Nisim that we can't possibly imagine. You can imagine Kriyas Yam Suf. You might not be able to do it, but you can imagine the sea splitting, you can imagine the land appearing, you can imagine it all. Right? A nace that we can't possibly imagine does not appear in the Torah. The Rambam, for example, says that you don't have to believe Even though we say Hashem could do anything, you don't have to believe, you're not obligated to believe, that Hashem could create a square, right, where one side is longer than the other. You can't have a square that's one side longer than the other. We can't imagine that, right? Or where the diagonal of the square is equivalent to one of its sides. We can't imagine that. So how could you have a nes of Zachar v'Shamar b'Diburecha? It doesn't make sense. Interesting question, what that is. And if you're curious for a really good answer, you can come over to the Q&A afterwards. But getting back to our point, in the second set of Dibur, at least I understand with Shabbat, that's one mitzvah. It's Shabbos. And the two different aspects of Shabbat, Zachar and Shabbat. But in Dvarim, we say, Lo tachmor eshet re'echa, v'lo titaveh beit re'echa. Now, lo titaveh is an entirely new issue. It's not the same as lo tachmor. So there's an isser, a prohibition, that appears in Vayetchanan, doesn't appear. And the Rambam is very clear about this. Right? The Rambam says, what's the difference between lo tachmor and lo titaveh? Right? So, kol ha-chomed avdo is somebody who desires what his neighbor has. Okay? V'ichbir alav b'rayim v'fzir bo ajil l'kachol menu. It's not just that you want what he has. You then don't take no for it. You want to buy from him, and he's not interested. And you start to pester him. You make him feel guilty. You say, come on, what do you need this Eka car? You got nine of them. And eventually, he sells it to you. Right? Natan lo damim rabim. Right? Ava bish natan lo damim. Even though you pay him more than market value. Over belota says, nemar lo tachmod. Lo tachmod is, I actually have to convince you to sell me something that you don't want to sell. I pay you for it, and that's the issue. But if I just want it, I'm not over the issue yet. Right? Okay. Kol ha-mitaveh, this is Perek Aleph Halacha Yud. Kol ha-mitaveh beito ishto v'kelav. Somebody who desires, kevan shechashav b'libo e'ach yitineh davar zeh, v'nifteh b'libo davar, avar b'lo ta'aseh. Lo titaveh is actually wanting it. It's planning in your mind, how am I going to get this? When you ask your neighbor, he's not interested in selling it. That's an issur of ratzon, right? So, how could you have two different issur? In the two sets of Aseret HaDibur, you can't say, b'diburecha, they're two different issur. What's the difference in lo tachmod and lo titaveh? By the way, it's interesting that in lo tachmod, in Vayetro, it starts with eshet re'echa. Lo titaveh, it starts with beit re'echa. Very different. What are the relationship between these two issurim and what's the mitzvah here? Right? Two more questions. Right? First of all, okay, so you're not allowed to want something that isn't yours. How do you overcome that? How do you change what you want? Like, it's normal to want things. You know, you get a job, you're living in Manhattan, and you have a job in Long Island, and you want a car. You want a car? It's not such a terrible thing. You want a car? Somebody says, you can't have the car. It belongs to him. You can't steal it. Okay, so you can resist doing that. But can you? How do you undo what you want? And lastly, we already have an issur of lo tinaf. You're not allowed to adulter. You're not allowed to want your neighbor's wife. Right? If I already have an issur of adultery, which is with Eshet Ish, right? Rashi says, let me see if I can find this. Rashi says very clearly, does he say it? Ein ni'uf ela b'Eshet Ish, that's what Rashi says. So we're talking about over an Isser with an Eshet Ish. So if I say lo tinaf, why do I need lo tachmod? And if anything, I would think lo tachmod should come first. Lo tachmod, don't want her. And then, ni'uf, you're not allowed to adulter with her. Once I've already said you can't adulter, what do I need? What's the difference in lo tinaf and lo tachmod? So we got five questions. First of all, why is this the end of the Aseret HaDibur? Second of all, right, why is this such a critical piece that it's one of the Aseret HaDibur? Third of all, why are there two separate isurim, lo tachmod and lo tinaf? And lo titaveh. Fourth of all, how do you change this? How do you change what you want? And fifth, what's the difference between ni'uf, adultery, and lo tachmod? So I want to share with you a deep idea. Okay? Here's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Famous Mishnah. Mishnah says as follows. This is in Parakeh. Asara nisyonot nitnasa Avram Avinu ve'amad b'kulam. Avram Avinu was tested. He successfully endures 10 trials. Okay? Lo'di akam achibato shel Avram Avinu alav hashalom. To let the world know how wonderful Avram Avinu was, how much Hashem loved him, and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, the Mishnah does not tell us what these Asara Nisyonot were. But the Rebbeinu Yonah does, right? He has the list of 10 Nisyonot, right? The first is the Kifshan and Rukazdim, that Avram survives being thrown into a furnace. The second is Lech Lecha, he has to leave his home. The third is Vayirav Ba'aretz, there's a famine, and he has to, after he just got to Israel, possibly, he has to go down to Egypt. The fourth is that Sarah, right, just a quote inside Rabbeinu Yonah, Lukacha Sarah leParo. Sarah was taken by Paro. Remember this? Avraham Avinu says, Imina Achotiat, tell me you're my sister, and is kidnapped by Paro. Okay. The fifth is Melchemet Arbat HaMlachim, the battle of the four, against the five kings, when he, you know, helps Lot, right? That's the fifth. The sixth is that he does a bris milah when he's 99 years old. And here it gets interesting. The seventh, I'll skip the seventh. The eighth is that he has to chase out Hagar and Yishmael. It's against his very nature because it's Baal Chesed. The ninth is Akedas Yitzchak. And the tenth is the burial of Sarah. Shem promised him he would have a chalka and he can't find a place to burn. What's the seventh that I skipped? Right? Lukacha Sarah Aide Avimelech. The seventh is, eight prakim later, after the first kidnapping, Sarah gets kidnapped a second time, 24 years later. Only this time she's kidnapped by Avimelech. Rabbeinu Yonah says, those are two of the Nisyonot. Ask me an obvious question.
Why is that a
Nisayon? Pardon? Why is that a Nisayon? Well, what's a Nisayon? The Ramban says a Nisayon is basically a trial allows us to reach our potential. So a tzaddik goes through a difficult trial. By accomplishing this, something which was only in potential, now he succeeds in doing it. Okay, so something was difficult to do, and he did it, yeah?
If you
can
do it once, is it true that he can do it again?
Ah! Once Sarah gets kidnapped, and he overcomes this, why are both of these kidnappings separate nisyonot? Now, give me an obvious answer. Mistama. Pardon? They must have been different. There must have been something going on in each of them which was different enough that they were two separate nisyonot. Okay? How do I understand that? Why is the second kidnapping included? So, I want to tell you an idea which I think will help us understand the difference between the first kidnapping and the second, why they're both nisyonot, which will help us understand the difference between Lo Tachmor and Lo Titaveh, and more importantly, will help us understand why Lo Tachmor is such a basic principle in Judaism. And that will be the end of the shiur. Okay? So, if you take a look at these two kidnappings, there are a couple of really interesting differences. First of all, one last point. What is missing from the Dibra of Lo Tinaf, especially based on what Rashi says? Yeah. It just says Lo Tinaf, you shouldn't adulter. Rashi comes along and says, Ein ni'uf ela be'esh edish. Adultery is about somebody else's wife. And that halachli is correct. You meet some girl in the street corner, she's a Baba Basra girl, and chas v'shalom, you're over an Issa d'Oraisa, or maybe Nisa d'Rabbanan, but you're not over Lo Tinaf, because she's not married. You're just an idiot, but okay, right? So, Lo Tinaf is Eshet Ish. Why doesn't it say Eshet Ish? Why by Lo Tachmol does it suddenly bring up Eshet Ish? And why, by the way, in Lo Tachmod, in Shmot, it starts with Eshet Ish, Lo Tachmod, Eshet Re'echa, but in Dvarim, right, let's just to quote you, right, in here it says Lo Tachmod, sorry, in Yitro it says, Lo Tachmor Beit Re'echa, Lo Tachmor Eshet Re'echa. It starts with the house, then it goes to the wife. And in Dvarim, it's the opposite. Lo Tachmor Eshet Re'echa, Lo Tachmor Beit Re'echa. Here the wife comes first, and the house comes next. So, why the difference? And how come the wife doesn't appear in the room? Right? Okay. So listen to this idea. This is an unbelievable idea. Right? What was the chait of the mitzvah? The mitzvah were a society of immorality. They lusted. The kidnapping of Sarah was a kidnapping of lust. In fact, the word paro comes from the word parua, which is basically sexual immorality. Right? That it all hangs out. So Sarah is kidnapped because she was beautiful and because they lusted her. And if you look at the psukim there, and I'll spare you, it says, you know, Atayadat, and now I see how beautiful you are, and the mitzvah will see that you're beautiful, and Rashi says the mitzvah saw she was beautiful. It's all about Rashi, Sarah's beautiful. We lust her. And in fact, if she's the most beautiful, she goes to Paro. Avimelech is a totally different story. In Avimelech, the story of Avimelech in Perek Chaf and Breshit, it doesn't even mention that Sarah is beautiful. In fact, the Ran in the Drashot Aran says that the chait of Avimelech was not about Sarah. It was actually about Avram. Avimelech kidnapped Sarah because he wants to get to Avram. He wants to demonstrate that he's in charge. He wants to show Avram who's boss. And the way he does this, he belittles Avram by kidnapping somebody from his family. The victim of Paro's kidnapping is Sarah. The victim of Sarah's kidnapping by Avimelech is Avram. And the word Avimelech, by the way, is Avimelech. My father is all powerful. The chait of Paro was a chait of lust. The chait of Avimelech was a chait of power. He's interested in control. Lo tinaf. Right? What's the difference between lo tachmod and lo titaveh? Lo tachmod is a chait of control. I want your house. Okay? I want to show who's in control. Lo titaveh, that's about ratzon, that's about desire. Those are two different chataim. What do they share in common? They share in common that what I want is what leads me to do what I shouldn't do. You know, Rav Nevetzel makes a really good point. What's the problem with Lo Tachmod? And this helps us understand how do you overcome Lo Tachmod. What's the problem with Lo Tachmod? Lo Titaveh. You know, he has a nice sweatshirt. And I like his sweatshirt. So I say to him, yo, dude, you know, you go to Boston, you can buy another one. Sell me a sweatshirt. He's like, I don't want to sell you a sweatshirt. I'm like, why not? It'll be such a great thing, you know. I'll write to our band, we'll start wearing boys' sweatshirts, it'll be great. He's like, no, I'm like, come on. How much did you pay for it? He says, well, I paid $30, but I don't want to pay. I said, I'm going to give you $100. Right? And then I say to him, wait a second, I just want to understand. Your Rebbe wants to buy a sweatshirt, and you're saying no? So finally, Lonaim, he's uncomfortable, so he sells me a sweatshirt. So I'm over in Isidoraisa. Right? What's the problem with that? The problem with that is, if you ask someone for something, and they say no, and Hashem gave it to them, it means you're not supposed to have it. To want that which Hashem hasn't given you is the core problem. It is the bookend of the Aseret HaDibur. The Aseret HaDibur begins by saying, Hashem runs the world. Hashem is the source of reality. And what I have is what Hashem wants me to have. And if I don't have something, there's a reason I don't have something. Pondering the fact that Hashem is the source of everything in my life is exactly how I undo the problem of Lo Titaveh. It is the other side of the coin of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Right? Now, what are the things that lead me down the road to this type of mistake? Right? So, if the issue with Lo Titaveh and Lo Tachmod is why do I want something Hashem doesn't want me to have? What's the flip side of that? I should really only want what Hashem wants me to want. Now think back to the beginning of our year. Right? What's the third question? First question is, what do I want? Second question is, why do I want it? What's the third question? Does Hashem want me to want it? It is unbelievable how many people never get to that last question. Does Hashem want me to want it? Now, this is a difficult question. At what point do you say, just because something isn't working out, maybe Hashem still wants me to want it, he just wants me to work harder for it? So if you, I don't know, fall out of Moses' course, and they give you a chance to go again, maybe Hashem wants to see if you're willing to put in extra work. That's a tough question. But at what point do you say, Hashem has decided this is not meant to be? You know? So you go, you meet a girl, right? You're in Baba Kama, she's in Baba Basra Gishmat. You ask her out, she says no. You say to yourself, you know what? My neshama tells me I need to spend time with this girl. So you don't take no for an answer, you send her roses. You write her a poem. At what point does courting a person become creepy? At what person do you need to realize Hashem doesn't want you to have this? Very difficult question. And that is the line between Lo Techmor and Lo Titaveh. To understand if there's an issur about wanting something to be controlling, like why do I need your car? I could buy a different car. What interests me is not that I have a car sometimes. What interests me is I want your car. That's a problem. How do I undo that? Hashem runs the world. That's the fundamental idea. And this mitzvah, right? First of all, it forces us to accept the fact that we are not in control. Some of you will remember that we spoke about Rav Chanan Wasserman and his treatise on Emunah. Said that what prevents us from acknowledging what we instinctively know, what we're born to know, that Hashem runs the world, that Hashem created everything, because otherwise you'd have to accept that everything is random. That's ridiculous. The reason people have a hard time accessing what they intuitively understand is because then they have to give up control. If Hashem created everything, and everything has a purpose, then I don't get to do everything I want to do. And that's very hard for people to do. And that's why this is part of the Aseret HaDibur. And the second important issue, right, is the importance, and we also spoke once about the mystery of Ratzon. Right? What you want is who you are. Nothing comes into our lives unless we want it to. And if something negative comes into our life, it's somehow tied into what we want in this world. So one of the most important things you can do is work on your Ratzon. Is to work on wanting what Hashem wants us to want. You know? So like you're in a base minhag at night because, hey, you're in Shiva and we're supposed to be at night too. But do you want it? How do you work on wanting it? How do you work on wanting the things that Hashem gives us simply because they allow us to be vehicles for making a better world? Right? And I'm just reminded of this story that we heard when we were in Poland, of a woman whose husband saw that the jig was up, it was time to get out, but this woman had ordered a set of linen. Do you remember the story? She'd ordered a set of linen. So she told her husband, I can't leave. We ordered the linen. The linen's coming. Right? The Nazis, and they're in Poland. It's time to get out. But then she'll lose her linen. It's expensive. So she says, you go ahead. I'll wait. The linen should be here in a week. I'll get the linen. I'll bring it with us. It's expensive. And I'll come. She never made it out. For a set of linen. What are the things we really want in this world? You know? Do we get it? There was a fellow by the name of Max Verborg. Max Verborg was one of the wealthiest Jews in Germany. He was on major boards. And as the Nazis came to power, and they committed, you know, what you might call the Great Theft. We talked about this in one of our shiurim recently, right? They created an economic boycott, and they intimidated Jews to sell their businesses. You know, I mean, this was all part of a plan. It wasn't just random. It isn't like a sidebar. You want to hear an unbelievable statistic? In 1933, there were 50,000 Jewish-owned businesses in Germany. By 1938, there were 9,000 left. They intimidated, bullied Jews to get rid of their businesses, 40,000 businesses, right? 5% of the German national budget in 1939 was loot from Jews. It was part of their budget to be able to collect this money, right? They had a law that they passed in 1938. There was a levy on all Jewish property. Every Jew had to list everything he owned, everything above 5,000 Reichsmarks. His furniture, his stocks, his life insurance policies, his houses, everything. And they prepared this list, and financial officers worked on this. And by the end of 1938, they had documents that survived the war of property of Jews worth over 7 billion Reichmarks. That's in 1938. Imagine the wealth that would be today. It was basically a system that made it ripe for state-sanctioned theft. And there's a fellow, his name was Max Barbaro, and he was one of the wealthiest Jews in Germany. He was on multiple boards, he was a huge businessman, very high-profile banker, and one by one, these boards excused him from the board. You know, because Germany, 1933, 34, 35, Nazi, Jew, not working. And he was forced out one after another. And most of his non-Jewish colleagues remained loudly silent, if you know what I mean. In fact, there was a custom when a person left the board, they would make a toast to his service to the business. But of course, nobody was willing to toast him. So we have a paper that survived the war. He toasted himself. You know, Mr. Borberg, thank you for your contribution to the company and for your service, and we wish you well. Because nobody's wishing him well. He was fired from the Hamburg American shipping line, and he realized it was time to get out. Now you have to understand, you couldn't take anything with you of value. You had to pay a 25% of your wealth tax to get out. So, like, far be it from us to sit in judgment. I mean, imagine, think about your parents. And the only way to get out of America is not to sell. You leave your house, you leave your business. I mean, can I not blame her? I'm almost 60 years old. Can you imagine starting from scratch? Not an easy thing to do. This guy's majorly wealthy. He realizes he has to get out. Can't take anything with him. So he manages to get out and he gets to America. And he actually ends up joining the American Army. He's no longer a wealthy guy. He becomes part of the team. He was a lawyer by trade. He becomes part of the team that interrogates Nazi war criminals in Nuremberg. Unbelievable. This is a fellow who said, I got to think about what's really important in life. What are the things I should want? All that stuff, that's not what's really valuable in this world. That's Lo Tachmod. What are my priorities? What are the things I really want? What are my goals? You know, you're sitting here and you're ready to go to college, so you can get that big plum job and earn a lot of money. Is that really what makes life meaningful? And that's why this is the 10th of the Aseret HaDibra. So there's a lot more to talk about on this topic. A little bit of food for thought on Parshat Yitro.